Alan Cobb, Donna Colby, and Bill Teeple, and this is Iowa Contemporary Art.
It is Iowa.
Iowa Contemporary Arts, Icons, Art Radio.
It is Iowa. It definitely is.
I have to remember that occasionally. Where I am.
It's the
that's
I
why we
icon.
Named the what we did, so I'll remember
yeah.
where I'm doing this thing, this lifetime. It's yuga. All right. Well, last week we were talking about really skill in action, success in activities, and that there's a kind of place we have to get to where we let go and follow our curiosity, and we then got to the point where what's the difference between someone who does that and gets somewhere and someone who seems to be doing that and doesn't get anywhere? In other words, the person that's sort of scattered and goes from thing to thing and it doesn't seem to be progressing anywhere, and the person who does that and ends up being Leonardo da Vinci.
Or some modest simulation.
Or something in between.
Or Dane Dowler.
Right. Yeah, or Donna Colby. I mean, somebody who writes and paints and takes photographs and cooks, let's say. There's four things. Some people, I had a friend a long time ago who her husband was encouraging her to have a career. And she wanted very much to have the respect and credibility of a career. So she went out and she learned photography. And she had a friend who was a movie producer and a director. And so he got her on the set of a couple of movies he was making as the unpaid still photographer. She took all these photos of movie stars and stuff. But she didn't make any money. And her husband was saying, well, we got to take it to the next step, which is to, start selling photographs, get them in galleries or get jobs as a photographer for something, but use your photography skills. And she said, what I really actually want to do is archaeological illustration. So she enrolled in some archaeology courses at UCLA and did all this stuff and was a very accomplished artist. So she drew beautiful pictures of pot shards and bits and pieces of things that you find in the ground. And then, the dig was over and it was time to start getting hired to do illustrations in magazines in the field of archaeology. And she decided she wanted to be a textile designer. And every six months later, she decided she wanted to write jingles. And so she had to get a synthesizer and a personal computer and all that stuff. And over 4 or 5 years, she had about 7 or 8 careers. And every one of them got started, and not a single one of them went past that step of, now you've proven that you can do this, so what are you going to do with it? And in her case, I think she was just insecure. She was afraid of flying. She was afraid to actually try it and get those rejection notices from all the journals or whatever. Not sell a single jingle for a year and start feeling like an idiot. And that certainly is a tremendous inhibiting factor, which you deal with whether you change jobs every 6 months or stay with one for your whole life. But the difference, I think, ultimately, if you're looking at the behavior of someone who has widely varying interests, is simply, What do they do with it? Do they accomplish anything? Are they feeling some satisfaction from what they do in life? You could be interested in all these things and not use the information for anything. You just enjoy learning it and move on to learn something else. There's nothing wrong with that. But there is something wrong with, I think, adopting a position or a posture or like starting a career. I'm going to be a photographer. And then 6 months later, you don't want to admit that you're not going to be a photographer. And so you sort of have to suddenly be a textile designer. It becomes a mechanism for avoiding things and not making any commitments. And the commitments aren't important to the world, they're important to you. If you don't make any commitments, then you don't have that experience of completing something and finding out what happens.
I mean, perhaps for her, though, I mean, I don't know her, and or perhaps for someone else in that same situation, if she really was trying to avoid things, it could be that she did complete what she wanted to complete in
right.
6 months, and that's all she needed
right.
to feel like, oh, now I've had the experience of being a photographer to as much
right.
of a degree as I
right.
want. Now I want to try being a textile designer and see what that's like. And she gets to a point. So it could
yeah.
be that the judgment of, oh, she should have stuck with it and she could have become great, were the other people's expectations. And
well,
for
that's, yeah.
her, you know, that may have been fullness.
But part of this, I think, is that she did almost every one of those things
that.
Out of obligation to
yeah.
do something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That
right.
given her own propensity, she might have just stayed at home and played with stuff in the living room.
Yeah, I mean, we never found out, I think, what she wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
She was coming up with things that would be good to do.
Because her husband wanted her to have a career, basically?
Well, and everyone else.
And
I mean,
she
yeah. wanted the status of having a career. There's no question that she wanted to be a professional and be treated with respect.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't see any way of being treated the way she wanted to be treated unless she had a good-looking career. And so she'd establish a career just to the point of where the rubber meets the road.
Mm-hmm.
And then if, in fact, that was what she really enjoyed doing, I mean, if we could have stepped back from it at the time and just talked about it, maybe she would have said, you know, I just love learning new things. I get into it and see how it works. And well, maybe there's something that comes out of that after a few years that you didn't expect. She
mm-hmm.
finds something she loves and sticks with it, or she finds that hopping from one thing to another for the rest of her life is what she is.
The way she wants to live her
you
life.
Know,
yeah.
She's a honeybee, and she's going to hop from flower to flower, and there's value in that. You know, and her husband would have been perfectly happy if she had been able to embrace what she was doing.
So there was not any point there that I feel like we were talking about in the last show where a person finally looks straight on mm-hmm. at what's going on with
right.
them, which
right.
is
what that's what
I was,
right. missing. Right.
Yeah, I was
that's
trying
the
to
key
do finally.
Right.
Question,
not to
yeah.
let the shoulds and octaves, whatever please thought of what I thought other people wanted me to do was I was doing, except I finally got to a point where I wanted to just look straight on at what it was to be me and to have my thoughts come and where they would lead me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And all the stuff that came along that said, your dharma, your dharma, your dharma, didn't come because I was looking for my dharma or looking for a career. It was that I was finally just standing where I was, looking at what I was looking at, talking about that. And
yeah.
suddenly I was doing my dharma.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think she
yeah.
never found it.
Right.
It's hard to get to that point, too.
Oh, this is the
innocence,
hardest thing. I think
you know,
this is
just
the crux of the matter, as
yeah.
I was saying
yeah.
in the last show. More than trying to find a career or anything like that.
Well, especially nowadays when in the information age, when you're always hearing every single day, you're bombarded with stories of other people's accomplishments and other people's, you know, pursuits of all sorts.
Yeah.
And my problem is I'll read about somebody or I'll see somebody on television or something like that and I'll go, ooh, I want to do that. That looks really cool. I want to try that. And some of the things are easy to try, like, you know, you watch some cooking show and you want to make that dish, and so you go and you make that dish. But other things, like what Alan was talking about before, where you have to buy expensive equipment in order to do that thing or travel to someplace, then you have to stop for a moment and ask yourself, why do I want to do this? Or, you know, do I
yeah.
really want to do this?
Yeah,
or,
how badly do I?
Yeah.
And then, but there is the point of really doing it, which is what
mm-hmm.
you brought up.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen so many people in the arts that approached something and spend mm-hmm. a lot of time getting ready
yeah.
with all the right equipment and learning how to
yeah.
work the tools and like that. But never figured out what you're supposed to do with it
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And never did anything
yeah.
with it. And
yeah.
I mean, this is a point in my teaching that I get to with all my students. Most of them come in because they're infatuated with the idea of being able to draw and paint, which is simply learning a language, a visual language. It's no different than learning French. And so once you have the visual language, then I have, once they do, I have to ask the students, what do you have to say with this language? And usually that's the most difficult point to address with the students. Some stop. And some, I help them to find their voice and what they have to say and who they are and what they love, which is what it's about.
It's difficult also the other way around. We've been talking about getting to a point where, you know, you're kind of blocked and you have to let go to let this flow start. But some people have a really easy time with the flow part. But for them, the hard part is getting to the point past the free writing or the just kind of playing with paint or something like that to actually refining the product that they're bringing out. And so, you know, you have this balance with your students, and usually it comes from that way around, from learning the technique and then freeing them so that they can...
Well, actually, I have both.
You have them both.
I have the people that are...
both ways.
That are... resist discipline and just want the free expression. And then I have the people that just feel safe in the discipline and can't get to free expression. And that's why we go from discipline to doodling and then doodling back to discipline.
So how do you inspire the people who are just like enjoying the freedom of just pure expression? How do you inspire them to be more disciplined?
Well, we look at the masterworks where there's a balance between structure and dynamism. And structure and free flow, and we see there's a difference between what the student is doing and what they did. In fact, I mean, to the point that the student will be frustrated. They will be frustrated. They will want me to help them. And so then we'll look at the masters and how they balance these things and how there's some discipline is needed. Some structure has to be there for this free flow to happen in, because they'll feel frustrated with their work. Because it'll get out of hand real fast because they won't have the craftsmanship tools and a discipline of mind-body coordination to be able to like keep it under control at all. So it just gets out of control, and so their work looks chaotic.
So you've gotten to that point then where they're motivated now to learn and be disciplined. But then how do you get over that step, like Alan was talking about before, where you realize that you're starting now to practice something, and it's going to take a while before you actually get good at it?
Well, I have to feel out the student, and if I feel the student doesn't need to know how to paint like John Singer Sargent or Da Vinci to express themselves, then I don't encourage them to go there. They won't stay, they won't do it. They won't be able, it'll just be impossible for them to do that type of discipline. So I figure out how they can add structure to their natural tendency of expression. It may just mean learning a few, to be able to control the paint they're working with in an expressionistic way just a little bit better. In other words, maybe they need to understand color relationships and color mixing a little bit better.
I see. So,
they have to learn, there has to be some level, they can't just continue to slop paint and create mud before they'll say, I'm just slopping paint and creating mud here and I'm frustrated. So I have to say, well, let's study, let's have the fun of making a color wheel and understanding how do you make mud. If I teach them how to make grays, blacks, and browns, then they'll know how to not make grays, blacks, and browns, and they will have a new discipline added to their expression.
So you break it into a smaller...
Yeah, I figure out what they're going to need to be able to get satisfaction and to progress and be able to say something meaningful and with structure with their natural tendencies.
Like learning a foreign language. You used the example before about learning a foreign language. If you want to learn to speak French, let's say, it's frustrating to just kind of take a course or, you know, look at a textbook if what you're learning are to say things that you actually would not really say if you went to France. They're just a different category of language. So, but if you were to study the exact sentences that you would need to interact with the kind of people you want to interact with in France, then you're inspired to.
And there's this sort of natural thing of the moment and of natural interaction and communication mm-hmm. that comes to play.
Yeah.
If you go to France and you just say, I want a cup of coffee, I want a cup of coffee, and yell and scream and throw a fit, and a wildly expressive and romantic fit, you're still not going to get a cup of coffee. I mean, the communication is not going to happen.
Yeah.
But if you don't know much French, but you've learned how to say, I want a cup of coffee, you'll get the cup of coffee, mm-hmm. and maybe there'll be some sweet interaction, there'll be some communion and communication, even though you don't speak French very well. Mm-hmm. And if you can learn French a little bit more, you might be able to move people deeply in France with your mm-hmm. presence and your knowledge and all of this, even though you don't speak very well.
I had that exact experience in France. My technique was to actually, before I went someplace, to go look through all that my dictionaries and my grammar books and everything and learn maybe 5 or 6 sentences that I might need in that setting. And then I had a little bit of knowledge of like small amounts of spontaneous conversation. And the few times that I had little mini conversations with people, street musicians or something like that, and mentioned in my little baby French, my daughter is a singer in England, and you know, or my son plays the violin also, but you play it like music or something like, you know, the people would always say, oh, you speak French so beautifully, even though I only knew, you know, 20 sentences maybe.
Which brings us back to your friend who studied photography and studied this and studied that. Mm-hmm. Some people spend all this time getting ready to do something.
Mm-hmm.
Like they can't go to France and they can't express their emotions and feeling directly to someone mm-hmm. until they learn how to speak French perfectly.
Yeah.
And this other, she could be one of those people too.
Yeah, it's a common syndrome, where getting ready.
You learn all this. Yeah. You know, there's getting ready, and
as
then
an
there's going
to
on
doing.
Stage.
Yeah, yeah.
And she may have had stage fright, which is what you had mentioned earlier.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Getting ready is a classic alternative to doing it, mm-hmm. whatever it is. You just keep getting ready, and I'm not quite ready yet, but boy, when I am ready, the world will stand up and cheer. I'm just not quite ready yet.
And it's a serious problem with artists because really good artists are perfectionists.
Yeah.
And in most cases, they don't want to show or go out or get people's, you know, critics' opinion and stuff until it's really, really the best they can possibly do.
Yeah.
But that can go on and on and on. So in many cases, as an artist, one of the main things you have to get a handle on is your perfectionism and realize there's a level of compromise that has to take place mm-hmm. of your highest where you think you have to be before you can that you have to like relax on and just go ahead and start to share it mm-hmm. Where you are at right now.
I had to swallow some serious craftsmanship commitments a long time ago that where I knew that anything that I made had to be something that was really nicely made, and it should have no evidence of imperfection in it. And, you know, it should be like a Brancusi or something. It's just a perfect form, and it's, you don't know how it was done, and you just enjoy what it is. And I've part of how I overcame that was in the approach that I use so much now, which is reusing things in ways they weren't intended to be used, so that the perfection of a piece of PVC pipe, which is in its own right a kind of marvelous thing, it's a long white cylinder that's almost perfect in every geometrical sense, and it's made of this uniform white substance that's just pure and white and has no grain or, you know, imperfections in it of any kind, apart from the atrocious barcode printing all down one side of it. And so if you can join a few of those things together in some interesting way, you get the perfection, but you also kind of have this sort of counterpoint of having made something that's really a perversion of the materials that you're using. It's not, you're not deplumbing in a house, you know, you're making a monorail or whatever whatever strange thing it is that you're building, or making a speaker system, you know, out of a slab of you know, kitchen cutting board with a hole cut in the middle of it.
So the showing of the thing to, or the sharing it with others, if you think about it, not that I'm sharing some absolutely perfect finished product, but I'm sharing part of my process, because for an artist, right, it's never going to be perfect enough, because by the time you're finished with it, you're already on to the motivation,
right,
for
it's
the next,
right,
piece. And so I used to be horrible about my artwork. As soon as they were finished, I mean, basically I would toss them on the floor because they didn't matter to me anymore. And other people would say, why are you treating your artwork so, you know, you could step on it? And they just didn't interest me once they were done. But they interested other people, and they meant something beyond the fact that I was a good artist. You know, if I got past the point of thinking I can only show things to prove that I'm a good artist, but instead show things to show, to just allow people to see what I'm working on and this stage in my process, then it, you relate to it a bit differently then.
Yeah, it's two completely different angles. And some people, mm-hmm, never get out of that first angle, mm-hmm, the ones that are living in impressions. Mm-hmm. But those who are lucky enough to get beyond that and get inside what it's all about, the process of creativity and art making and moving through life and sharing in a spontaneous and effortless way, that's what life's all about. But many of us are caught up, and that's where the shoulds and ought tos and what other people think and all of this, and what we're taught. You were saying that all of the media and everything makes it look like you have to be one of these successful people or else you're like a worthless, mm-hmm, nothing. And it's none of that is the way it is.
And yet we love to see the champions, you know. It's like everybody loves to watch the people winning the gold medal at the Olympics and, you know, winning the Oscar and all that, because there is something inspiring about somebody who just, it does something so astonishing we can't even imagine having enough skill to do that.
But I think they did the astonishing thing after they got over this hurdle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That it had to do with getting inside the thing itself. Like, mm-hmm, the skater isn't, mm-hmm, he didn't become a champion because he
just wanted to be a champion.
Yeah, yeah, that's like the kids. There's kids in my classes, young kids, and you see them practicing their signature. Or you see young kids, even younger, practicing their speech that they will give when they accept their Academy Award. You know, they're living in a what other people think of me, and the best, mm-hmm, thing that I could be is like an Academy Award winner. Mm-hmm. But the people that are actually getting the Academy Awards, maybe they got launched into a direction at that other level and going through all the trouble to become one of those. But in most cases, there's a point, I think, in which the thing itself that they got into, and this is what your friend couldn't do, mm-hmm, became one with it. Mm-hmm. Their individuality sort of went away, and their intelligence became one with that particular area of the universe that had to do with skating, mm-hmm, real fast.
Yeah, or in acting, I love to watch on the DVDs, I love to watch the special features where you watch the entire film again with the commentary, mm-hmm, by the director or by the actors or whatever, and get an insight into what exactly it was they were feeling when they were making, mm-hmm, this project. And it brings out exactly what you were just talking about, you know, that, well, I wanted to explore light in this way, and the way I used color to bring out this emotion, and you see the movie in such a more beautiful way when you know that.
Almost any time you start to or talk to or you hear someone making a commentary, that's why I like to play so many interviews with real artists, is that you go, wow, they're into this thing that I was looking at in a kind of surface way, mm-hmm. in a really deep way.
Yeah.
And it a little bit
or
opens
a really
to you.
Playful way too, you know. It's like,
well, I mean, just that they're seeing like a dog. You can see a dog smelling, mm-hmm. and you know that they're in a universe that I can't be aware of. And I think almost everybody that's really famous and really accomplished in any area, it's almost like that. From our point of view, we can see like that he's sniffing around in there, and yet when you get some glimpse of what their world is, you realize it's this. They've gone deeply into exploration in a playful way, a natural and spontaneous way.
Whenever we talk about these things, it just makes me want to go home and do exactly what we were talking about. Go experiment and play. And
yeah, I think I want to go into textile design for a little while.
Well, I've been having this conversation now for days, ever since we had that odd Thursday last week.
Life about, as art.
Yeah, and because that's basically what I do. And someone was raised, I'll say this in 48 seconds. Someone raised the issue, people have said it's too bad you don't make paintings anymore, that Bill doesn't make paintings and drawings anymore. Mm-hmm. But they don't realize that this very point that we're discussing today is my quest and what I'm doing, and that my moving through life has become I'm the canvas now, mm-hmm. and moving through life is my way of doing this.
Yeah,
that's what we all really have to discover, that our lives are the canvas, and maybe there isn't any artist that we can find in the immediate environment. It's just happening, and getting out of the way is the only way you can get in the way, the only way you can get into the process.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.